So in this text called Kaivalya Upanishad, the student approaches the teacher and asks for the highest knowledge which will take him beyond sorrow, take him beyond whatever the world gives him. And so the teacher says, you can get it by faith, by devotion or love for God, and by meditation. And we have talked about these in the past few weeks. And then he says that this knowledge cannot be obtained by effort, by working. Effort helps, but it cannot be the ultimate. Nobody else can take you to this highest state. And you cannot buy it by wealth. You cannot buy your way to the highest. Only by renunciation, by dispassion. We had 2 weeks ago, actually last week, we had talked about what is this renunciation, what is this detachment, where you withdraw from physical, mental, and intellectual activities, from the world of objects, emotions, and thoughts, and turn your attention inward to the Lord. So today we will continue this teaching. So page number 19 in your text is verse number 4. We'll break it down because it will be hard for everybody to chant. Vedanta Vijnana Sunishchitartha Sanyasa Yogat Yataya Shuddha Sattvaha. Te Brahma Lokeshu Parantakale Paramritat Parimujyanti Sarve. We'll just chant it together. I'll chant it. If you can go with me, it's fine. If not, you can just listen. It says, Vedanta Vijnana Sunishchitartha Sanyasa Yogat Yataya Shuddha Sattvaha Te Brahma Lokeshu Parant Kale Paramritat Parimujyanti Sarve. So we'll go word by word. Vedanta Vijnana. Vedanta. Vedas are the holy books of the Hindus of ancient India. And the first three portions are related to the rituals, to prayers to God, and praise of nature. Praise of the Lord who has created nature. So appreciation of nature and prayers to God and a lot of elaborate rituals, and also how one can become a good individual. So those are covered in the first three portions. The last portion called the Anta, Veda. Anta means the end or the highest is the Vedanta, is the Upanishad. What we are doing is the highest knowledge, which tells me who am I, what is this God, what is the world, and what is my relationship to God. So it is the highest knowledge. So he says Vedanta Vijnana. Vijnana means, Jnana is knowledge. Vijnana means, Visheshena Jnana means special knowledge. What happens is, you have learned how to, you have gone to medical school and become a doctor. But then when you are faced with a patient, you go out and into the hospital and you see your first patient and your knowledge deserts you and you don't know what to do, or you have learned all the recipes and you have memorized them. But when you start cooking, you are not able to translate that recipe into food, and the food that comes out, nobody can eat. So knowledge is one thing, but then application of the knowledge into the world is a separate thing. So Vijnana means this person not only has the knowledge of the highest truth, but is able to apply that in his life. He is able to bring it into his life. Otherwise, reading the scriptures, you know, you read the Bible, you go to church, or, you know, you go to the temple, you listen to all the sermons, but then when you come out, if there is no change in your behavior, if you don't change how you deal with the world, how you interact, if you're not improving, you're not getting better, then your knowledge is useless. So that's why they say one, knowledge should be accompanied by practice. What I have studied, I should be able to apply in the marketplace. Swami Chinmayananda used to say, when the rubber hits the road, you know, when you go out and then you say, oh, one should be very loving, kind, compassionate, and, you know, charitable. And then somebody says something to you at work or at home, and then suddenly all your knowledge goes out the door and you say things you shouldn't have said and all. So then that's when they say that's when the knowledge is tested. So this person has not only studied the Vedanta but has applied that. And it says sunishchitartha. Sunishchitartha means firm understanding. Firm understanding of this knowledge. What do we mean by firm understanding? You know, you have an engineer and you've broken your old house and you made a multi-story apartment building which you want to rent out and you want. And so the engineer says, you know, you need to make a foundation of 6 feet deep. So you say 6 feet seems less, you know, I'm making a tall building. You think the foundation will hold it? I'm not sure. It may not. So what kind of engineer is that? I'm not sure whether my building will stand or will break the next day. You have to know exactly. Or you go to a doctor and say, doctor, what's wrong with me? And he looks at you, he says, take this medicine. If I take this medicine, will I get well? I'm not sure. You may get well, you may not get well. He said, come on, let me get a second opinion. So this individual, his knowledge is firm. He knows what he has studied is the right knowledge, and his understanding is clear. Nobody can disturb him, nobody can move him, because his understanding is so perfect that no matter even the greatest sorrow comes in the world, he does not deviate from his knowledge that, you know, God is within me and he's all merciful and whatever is happening is happening. So a person who has firmly decided and has a clear and firm understanding of this knowledge is called sunishchitartha. His knowledge is very clear and firm. And then it says sannyasa yogat. Sannyas means to detach, and yoga means to attach. So they say detach and attach. These are two separate things. So they say make up your mind. Do you want me to detach or do you want me to attach? How it's like saying, you know, in another place, Krishna in the Gita says, dissociation from association with sorrow. What did you say? Dissociation from association with sorrow. So what they mean is that whatever you have acquired in the world, whether it's objects, whether it's people, even your own body, whatever objects I see in this world, objects can be a house, a car, a job. Objects can even be people, my husband, my wife, my child. And objects can be even this body. This body is also an object that I perceive. So anything that you perceive, whether it's your body, whether it's your relatives, your friends, or your possessions, sooner or later will give you sorrow. Sooner or later, anything you possess in the world will give you sorrow. Your body will give you sorrow, your mind and intellect. Body as it gets older, mind and intellect, as again it gets older, it gets confused, it will give you sorrow. Mind, of course, somebody, you know, you're happy, one day you're unhappy. So your body, mind, intellect give you sorrow. Objects also, the house or a car, initially it's very good, but then the car starts breaking down and then you have to call AAA and then you have to spend $500 or $1,000 to repair it, and then the tires are gone, the battery is gone, the tramp, everything slowly. Then this car which was giving you joy gives me sorrow, or the house. Same thing. Once the house starts breaking, everything is falling apart. Relationships, you know, initially I gave me a lot of joy, and now I'm getting sorrow, you know, from my near and dear ones. So one has to understand that nothing in the world is going to give me permanent joy, permanent happiness. For a while, yes, and it's okay, enjoy it while it's, but do not depend on happiness, on anything in this world to give you permanent joy. The only permanent joy is the Lord's presence within, and once you discover that, so detach from the world and attach to the higher. Detach from the world and attach to God. And God is everywhere. He's there in all beings, all plants, animals, also within me as life. He is my essential nature. That is who I really am. I am that spirit. So hold on to that idea. Attach to God and detach from the world is the best way to achieve success. Then it says, strive, yataya. Yataya means those who strive, those who succeed. And then they talk about Shuddha Sattvaha. So let us talk about Shuddha Sattva, or the pure mind. That is one of the words, Shuddha Sattva, pure mind. What is a pure mind? In the commentary, it is said a pure mind, that is a mind without disturbances, without agitation, is a pure mind. So a mind that is calm, that is peaceful, is called a pure mind. That's why when you wake up in the morning, you have had a good night rest, your mind is relatively calm, and then you get up and meditate or do some prayer, or maybe go for a walk and watch the sunrise, your mind is peaceful. And then as you go out and deal with the people and situations, your mind gets disturbed. So what is a pure mind? So they say, pure mind is, the answer is intake equals output. In computer language, there is a very famous saying, garbage in, garbage out. So if the data you're putting in the computer is faulty, then the results coming out will be faulty, because the computer is a machine. It cannot think. It can only basically create data. So based on the input you have put in the computer, that's the output you will get. So similarly, the mind is like a computer. If you put the right data in the mind, the output will be good. So if I have put in my mind a lot of negative thoughts and ideas, you know, and I watch violent movies and, you know, and, or watch the 11 o'clock news before I go to bed, and then read all the wrong kinds of books and go to the wrong websites in the computer and read the, you know, associate with the wrong kind of people. You know, there are some people who are very angry and who are very hostile, and they promote that in everybody. You know, we need to do all this, we need to get rid of these people, so this negative type of thinking people, when you associate with them, then what happens is your mind also becomes negative. So negative intake equals negative output. So they say fill your mind with positive thoughts, with thoughts of love and compassion. Remove hatred and anger and jealousy and prejudice and selfishness. Associate with good people and with good books. Read good books, watch good TV shows. You can be discriminative. What kind of websites you go to, what you research on the internet, what you get in the read in the news. So be selective, and as you fill your mind with positive thoughts and positive ideas, so also your output will be positive. So to purify the mind, you have to put good things in the mind. So that is what they say, good ideas, good thoughts, good intake equals good output. So that's why a saint, you know, his mind is full of love for all, because the saint always thinks about God and, you know, associates with God and thinks about the love and compassion and sees God in everybody. So that kind of an attitude we need to develop in our thinking. That is called a pure mind. The next is striving. Striving in Sanskrit is word sadhana. Sadhana yatayaha. Yatayaha is what is here it said. Yatayaha. Self-controlled sages or those who strive. So what is the meaning of striving or sadhana? What is the meaning of striving or going towards the higher? So they say striving or effort can be external or can be internal. So our sadhana, our spiritual practices can be external or can be internal. What do we mean by external and internal spiritual practices? So in, I don't know if those, do you know the Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga? Some of you must have heard about that, the eight limbs. Those who have done yoga, their teachers must have taught them. But there are eight limbs, Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahar, Dharana, Dhyana, Samadhi. Actually, I should keep it a little closer. So Yama, so there are Yama is self-control. Niyama is living a life of morality, dealing with others in a moral values. Asana are the physical postures. You know, when you go for a yoga class, he will tell you to do the posture, you know, the sun salutation or the cobra posture, you know, all those so postures. And pranayama is breath control. So these are external. So how I live my life with self-control, do not overindulge, do not overeat, do not over, you know, indulge in all the sense pleasures, live a life of moderation. Does not mean you become a saint and don't do anything, but live a life of self-control. And niyama is morality. Morality is how do I deal with other people in this world? How do I deal? How do I share? How do I live a life of harmony with everybody? Living a life of harmony reminds me of a little story. So this mother was making pancakes, and there were the older brother and the younger brother, and they were fighting. I'll get the first pancake. I'll get the first pancake. You know, both of them wanted the first pancake. So she says, you know what? She wanted to teach them a lesson in morality. So she says, if Jesus were here, what would he say? So they become silent. She says, if Jesus were here, he would say, let my brother have the first pancake, right? If Jesus were here, he would say, let my brother have the first pancake. So the younger brother tells the older brother, okay, you be Jesus. So morality is how do I share with the world? How do I give? How do I sacrifice? And then asana are the physical postures and pranayama are the breath control. So these are called the bahirang or the external. So external spiritual practices are dealing with the world, you know, living self-control, doing the right things, sacrifice, doing prayers, going to the church, going on pilgrimages, you know, going to holy places, doing charity, you know, doing building a house, building a house for the poor, a hospital, a church. So those are all external sadhanas. Internal are called pratyahar or withdrawal. Withdrawal means I withdraw from the world and dharana, and I resolve to do the right thing. What happens is our mind is all the time engrossed in the world outside. So I withdraw from the world and I decide that my goal is within. So that resolve that I no longer am going to depend on the world for my happiness, finding happiness within. And that's what we practice in meditation. We go within where we find the truth. So that is an internal. So withdrawal is not a physical withdrawal. It doesn't mean I put on orange clothes or put on a priest's habit and, you know, go to a monastery. I continue to do my work, but without the attachment, without dependence. I do what is required without likes and dislikes. So it's a mental attitude of withdrawal. It's not a physical attitude. It's not giving up work, but changing the attitude. And then resolve to go inward. And then when I sit for meditation, and ultimately dhyana, and then in samadhi, I merge. I become one with that truth. So there are external practices which we do, we talked about, and then the external practices have to lead to internal change in your mental attitude. So that is called yataya. Those are the people who have resolved, who have decided what I'm going to do, what is right, what is my goal and purpose in life, and then they act on that. So that's what they are saying, that these people, A, they have understood the scriptures very clearly. B, they have withdrawn from the world, do not depend on the world for happiness, or depend on happiness within, depend for their happiness on God. Their understanding is firm and clear, and their mind is pure. Their mind has become pure because of pure activities, and they are striving all their activities are geared towards the highest goal. As we have talked before, a person wanting to win the Olympics 8 years from now, he's not going to start in the seventh year, you know, okay, from now I have to decide to compete. He'll never get anywhere. 8 years before they start competing, you know, what kind of exercise I should do, what kind of diet. He'll get a proper coach, he'll get an instructor, he'll start reducing his wasteful activities. His goal is to win the Olympics, so 8 years of effort goes into winning the Olympics. So not only his external diet, but his mental attitude, that I have to win. So that attitude, when this person works with, that I have to win, it is my highest goal, and no matter what happens, and then he withdraws from the world. Then he doesn't go out late night to parties and, you know, drinking with friends and eating whatever. No, he will eat the right thing. He will associate with, if he wants to be a good athlete, he will associate with athletes and coaches and people who say, come on, you know, let's have a few drinks and let's stay out late at night and let's, you know, let's play poker all night. And he's no longer interested in that, because his goal is to win the Olympics. So similarly, a person whose goal is spirituality does not dissipate his energies in just wasting his time in, you know, just reading useless books or associating with people who say, come on, you know, why do you need to meditate? Why do you need to go to these classes? Come on, let's go to the bar and get a few drinks, or let's go and have a good time, or let's go to Vegas for the weekend. He'll say, no, my goal is clear. I have to get up in the morning and meditate. I'm not going to stay up till 12, 1 and 2 o'clock. I have to read the right kind of books. So the ability to not only control the external environment, but also to control his internal environment. And that's very important. We have to control our inner equipment, our mind. See, the body is external, but the mind and intellect are my internal equipment. So I not only have to keep my body healthy, you know, we are very particular about what we eat. You know, we are very particular nowadays. You know, I want to eat organic. You know, people are into organic. And then the air, you know, the air is not clean in Bakersfield, so let's move to the coast. Or they put air purifiers in their house or humidifiers. And I have a friend of mine who every room has a purifier. He said, oh, the air in Bakersfield is terrible. I don't want my children to be exposed. So he has air purifiers in every room. So we are very particular about what we put in our body, our diet, what the air we breathe. But we are not particular about what we put in our mind. We let anything and everything come in. Anything, and I don't eat anything on the roadside. If there is some food I know is not clean, I'm not going to eat it. But in the mind, even the roadside, anybody can put anything, and we allow that to happen. So just as I'm particular about what I eat in my body, I'm particular about my exercise, I'm particular about my heart, I'm particular about my lungs, I'm particular about my digestion. So just as I'm particular about what I put in my body and in my inside, so similarly I have to be very watchful what I put in my mind, what I put in my intellect, the kind of books I read, the kind of people I associate with, the kind of TV shows. So one who regulates his mind, such a person, mind has become pure, and with the right kind of activities, his external and internal purity is both very important. See, we spend a lot of time cleaning our body, washing our body, putting makeup and getting plastic surgery and doing all those exercises and everything. But we have to be equally careful about our mind and do not let people put garbage. Like somebody throws trash outside your house, we get very upset, right? Why did he throw trash in my house? But if he's putting trash in our mind, we are not. You know, we allow anybody and everybody. So be watchful, be very protective. So that is the first line of this verse. The second line we'll do next week. There's a lot of ideas. Is everything clear to everybody, or do you have any questions, any comments, anything you would like to add or disagree with or agree?
Because I notice, like, a lot of people at work, and even my sister, you can tell just by what, like, what I tell you about my sister, what CNN 24 hours a day, she's like constantly like this, and I feel I can't be like that. That's why I try on a daily basis to watch what I put on my mind and watch what I read. I don't even watch the news, because there's nothing good on there. Yeah, you're right. It's not about what you put on your mind. It affects you really good if you let it. It can get out of control.
Right, absolutely. No, that's why people have mental disturbances, you know, mental agitations, and then their mind is upset. And because, see, some people just watch the news, like when these 9/11 happened, September 11, it was tragedy, you know, the world towers got broken. But after that, for weeks on end, the TV all day, they would be only showing that, the planes crashing. And people all day were watching that, all day. And so after a while, they became paranoid. You know, America is being attacked. I don't know if I will survive. And people had to go to the psychiatrist, and they had trouble sleeping, and they were taking sleeping pills. And I mean, it's okay, it's a tragedy, but if you keep on watching, and the media loves to do that, the media will only promote the bad news. See, if there is something good happening, it's not going to make it on TV. But if somebody went out and shot 5 people, or somebody killed somebody, that becomes big news, and they love it. Everybody's watching, and then they'll go interview. Like this TV reporter got shot, you know, that video became viral all over the world. People were watching. So bad news spreads very quickly. But if somebody is doing something good, that's not news. So TV also love bad news. And so they keep on showing it. And that's why you said that this on news, what you watch. So if you keep watching, and like this thing happening again and again and again, then what do you think? This world is all bad. Everybody's bad. Everybody, there are murderers going around, and there are mass killings going around, and people are killing people. And so we get so afraid, you know, people are afraid. Kids are afraid to play outside. I remember when we were young, we used to run around and play always outside. There was no fear. Now there people are afraid to let their child go out. Why? Because, oh, somebody in Boston got kidnapped, and the TV, you know, makes it out like there is an epidemic. And it's not that bad. The world is still always was the same. There's a mixture of good and bad, but people live in fear. Everybody has a gun now. Why? Because in case the criminal comes, he has a gun, so I have to have a gun. Not only I have to have a gun, I have to have 3 and 5 guns, and I have to have a submachine gun, so I can kill the criminal before. And so we live in fear, you know, and that's the problem. And then who gets hurt with a gun? It's not the criminal. It's usually a kid shoots his brother or his friend, or, you know, because the children get into it, or in anger the wrong person gets shot. So the point is that if you live a life of fear, then that's what happens. Because the media makes it out like that, the whole world is out to get you, and you know, that's the problem. You have a good point. Thank you.
I was watching yesterday, on the best beaches and the best, like in Europe, best restaurant tours. It was pretty interesting. But every time there was commercial, I would flick it because the commercial was nothing about bad stuff.
Right.
So I'd have to click because I don't want to see that. I would just click it and then go back to again. But even the commercials are not even good anymore. They're just bad commercials, you know.
Right. No, TV is full of three things: sex, food, and violence. If you look at TV, that's all there is. There is nothing beside that. Sex, food, and violence. Either they're talking about food, or they're promoting sex, or they're promoting violence. There is not much good things happening, and you have to be very selective.
Yes. For medicine.
Yeah.
For depression. Oh, yeah.
For medicine, for depression, right. Because they get you depressed and then they sell you medicine for depression.
When you can consciousness been achieved or enunciation can be done without even you acquiring, enduring a divinity somewhere?
Right. Well, actually the Kaivalya Upanishad, the first, in the beginning they adore God, but then the second half is exact King Janaka. It is exactly the same thing. What you read in the second chapter will be covering in this. So what happens is that a seeker, even King Janaka was a very spiritual person. He was very good. He was praying and all that. He was not a atheist. But that state of realization is different from anything on this world. Nothing in this world equals that. And at that time, when a person realizes, then he realizes that all these forms, these are all forms, right? Whether it's Jesus on the cross, or whether it's Ganpati or Krishna or Shiva, these are all forms, whether it's Mother Mary. Forms are only a temporary appearance. It's not permanent. The permanent reality is formless. The highest reality, there is no form in that. It is beyond all forms. In fact, Krishna himself, when he says I, he does not mean Krishna in the form. He does not mean the one playing the flute. He means the one, the infinite consciousness, the formless. So when you reach that state of formlessness, and you realize I am formless, I am not with this form, then all forms disappear. Then he sees everything is that one formless, all-pervading reality, which is me. And then he has actually become one with that reality. He has become one with God, so there is no difference. So that's why he can say I. I means... Right. I, that highest reality, not I, the King Janaka, but I, that Om, that consciousness, that Brahman, that is the I he is referring to. And in that state, not like in this dream, when you are in a dream, you see all different forms. When you wake up, all the dream disappears, right? Into the waker's mind. So when you wake up to that state, then this whole world disappears. For that individual, disappears does not mean that the world evaporates. He does not give any reality to the world because he sees that this whole thing is a projection upon that one formless consciousness that is supporting everything without touching it. He says, I support everything without touching it. So it's not that he's not religious. He has gone beyond the form to become one with the formless. So, no, Janaka was a very, very, very spiritual, very holy person, very good, very kind, very loving. He was the best king. Even though he was a king, he was very generous, very, very, very good person. He's given an ideal. Even Krishna says that you have to be like Janaka, who continued to work as a king, at the same time was a realized master. In fact, saints used to come and study from him. great scholars used to come and study from this king. That was the extent of his knowledge. In fact, Ved Vyas sends his son that you go study from King Janaka.
Putting it in historical context, was
yes.
King Janaka the father of
Sita? Sita, yes.
But then Rama's avatar occurred thousands of years before Krishna's, right?
Yes. So Krishna refers to Rama, no? Refers to King Janaka, yes. So Krishna says you need to be like Janaka. Janaka had already appeared before him. So historically, yes. Krishna was later.
I'm trying to tie what I'm learning.
No, it's very good. Very good too. But the same thing will happen in this book too. He starts out by praying to God and says, God, you know, you save me and all that. And then ultimately he says, where is the God? I am everything. In me, this whole world arises. He says that. Mayeva sakalam jatam, mai sarvam pratishtitam, mai sarvam layam yati, tat brahmadvayam asmeham. He says, I am that non-dual Brahman, and in me, this whole universe has risen, and I sustain this whole universe, and this whole universe merges back into me. The student says exactly the same thing. You will see that in the later verses. So that's why this text is so beautiful, because it takes you from the simple to the higher. So, and through the technique of meditation. That's why I thought it will be very useful to us. If you read it, you will find that he becomes like King Janaka. Totally, the student becomes like him. Ultimately, the whoever is... But the thing is, this Jesus and, you know, Shankaracharya, they all experience the same truth. But depending on the audience, their teachings were different. Jesus was talking to fishermen in Galilee. So his teachings were geared towards that. He said, there is God, you need to love him, you need to love thy neighbor. It's not that he was any less evolved than any of the great sages. Buddha was talking to, you know, different people. Muhammad was talking to warriors. So his teachings were based upon, you know, how, you know. So what I'm saying is, depending on the audience, the teachings were different, but all of these prophets had reached that same truth. But if Jesus had started telling those fishermen, you are that Brahman and all, then they would have, you know, never sat with him. They wouldn't have understood what he's saying. So based on the time, based on the students, the teachings vary. But the essential truth in all is the same. That's why Jesus said, the Father in heaven and I are one. He who has seen me has seen the Father. It was not a statement of arrogance. It was a statement of truth. And I am the Father in heaven. That is me. I am not separate from him. So it's the same thing. You know, that who is the Father in heaven? The Father in heaven is the Brahman, the total reality that supports the whole universe. And Jesus says, I am that. I am my Father. I am not separate from him. So it is the same understanding. Thank you. That's a good question. I hope I was able to.
Yeah.
I think the more you read, the same ideas will get repeated everywhere. Even Vimalji, when he comes in September, we'll have him. He will, you know, do something very similar. The more we go into this detail, it will be repeated again and again. It's not arrogance. It's actually humility. Because that I no longer exists. That I, the perceiver, feeler, and thinker, no longer exist. That alone is me. And that understanding. Then I am not this perceiver, feeler, and thinker. I am just this consciousness occupying this body. This body is my car. That's all it is. It's not me. It's not me. Yes, my vehicle, my car. It's not me.
Up until now, which implies that it implies whatever that feels like, but it implies that knowledge can expand.
Right. Also, the thing is, we do know little, like, okay, I know a little bit of Vedanta and I'm speaking here, but you ask me about Buddhism, I know nothing. Ask me about Confucianism, I know nothing. Ask me about Judaism, I know nothing. Ask me about German philosophers and Huxley and all. I know nothing. So there is so much knowledge out in the world. Our knowledge is very limited. So the idea is that A, it should not get you arrogant. The more you evolve spiritually, the more humble you get. If spirituality brings arrogance, that I know a lot and all these people here don't know anything and I'm teaching them, then you have not studied. So all these, the greater you are spiritually, the more humble you become. Look at Jesus. He was the most humble. Look at Buddha. He was so humble. You know, he had no arrogance at all. So the point is that if knowledge brings arrogance, then you have not studied. The knowledge should make you humble, because there is one who is the source of all the knowledge, who has given me whatever knowledge I have, has been given by the Lord. And compared to that, I am very limited. I am very small compared to how much God knows. He knows everything of the whole universe, not only this world, but he knows of all the universes, all the worlds. How much do I know? I know little bit of little bit of a little bit. So, but at the same time, one has to go deep into that, focus and become specialist. Specialize in that instead of trying to read too much, trying to read Buddhism and then German and then confusion. Every day reading a different philosophy will confuse you. Pick up one style, go deep into it. And once you reach that depth, then you will understand that all knowledges lead to that one. All the world's knowledges, whether it's Buddhism, whether it's Christianity, Confucianism, leads to that one self. And once you reach that, then that I disappears, then you become everything. That's why Swamiji says, either say I am nothing or I am everything. The problem is when I say I am something. When I'm something, that's when if you say I'm nothing, you know, nothing, that's good. Or I'm everything, everything in this universe is me. Either way, you're okay. When you say I'm nothing, means there is nothing real. Everything is that one. So who am I? I'm nobody. Or I am everybody. Everybody is me. But when I say I am somebody, that's when the problem arises. So humility takes you to recognize that there is a lot more that I don't know. That's what they mean by that. It does not mean, they have very profound, Swami Ishwarananda ji has been studying and teaching for about 30 years. And he's a wonderful teacher, but he has no arrogance. Vimal ji, who will be coming in September, one of the most humble people you can ever meet, most modest, and he has been teaching since 25 years. Very simple. He'll be here in September. You should hear him. Very good, very humble, very modest. So these are examples for us so that we don't become arrogant. That is the idea. Not that I'm useless. It doesn't mean that. I am, how can I be useless? I am that reality. God is in me. God is functioning through me. How can I be useless? When God is in me and working through me, I am, you know, supreme. I am superior. I am a superior person. But it does not, should not lead to arrogance. God is working through me. I am not doing anything. I am not the doer. He is the doer. He is working through me. When that attitude comes, then automatically humility comes. Otherwise, I did so much. I am so great. I am so wonderful. You know, those qualities, especially spiritual arrogance, is very subtle. One has to always be very watchful, because you can very quickly get, you know, when you get praised, you get very quickly arrogant, you know, that I am somebody great. And so that's why these saints, Maha teachers, are very cautious about that. And that's why they repeatedly say that, what little I know, not to develop that ego. It's not a negative statement. It's just a way of not developing the ego, because so many people go and praise them. I also say, oh Swamiji, that was a great lecture, I benefited so much, I learned so much. And if they start taking everything to heart, then their brain will become swelled up. They won't be able to walk through the door.
When you know more, I think you have to refrain much. You have a moral responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Where people ignorant.
True.
Ignorance can be very very connected to all that.
Dangerous, yeah. Right. Or people who know very little and they think they know it all.
Yeah.
See, they're even more problem. Who know a little, but they think they know everything. And so taking a small as the absolute, that is where the problem comes. That's where fanaticism comes and intolerance.
So modesty in that sense, to me, really is not negative. I mean, you're supposed to be modest.
Right.
Because you're so little.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have given this whole universe, this whole knowledge
right.
that you don't understand, you know, so you have to be grateful.
Right. Right. Yeah, look at this whole universe. Earth is only one small little planet, and there are billions of stars and billions of planets. And in that whole Earth, America is a small part of that Earth. And out of America, California is a small part of America. There are 50 states. And out of California, there is a small little city called Bakersfield. And in that little city of Bakersfield, I have my little house and I have this. What am I, you know, compared to the whole universe? It automatically makes you humble. You know, if you look at my house in the whole universe, it's not even a speck. And I think I am so great, or my business, or, you know, it's so tiny. Even Bakersfield in the whole world, you won't even find it in the map of the world. So, and Bakersfield we think is a big city, but it's nothing compared to. So automatically humility has to come. So modesty is not, does not, it's not negative. Modesty is actually a positive quality. It's not a negative quality. Arrogance is a negative quality. Modesty is a positive quality. If you look in the values in the Bhagavad Gita, the modesty is a positive quality. Arrogance is negative, to show that I am great. So being modest is actually a positive. It's not negative. It's how you interpret. That's what it is.
Yes, sir. Tells a student, you know, what little I know is, you know, it's, he loses.
I think when you're trying to be an expert in your field, when you're being an specialist whether in medicine or professor or engineering or science, you have to show that. But you are specialist only in that narrow field, like a gastroenterologist like me. If I start taking care of people with heart problems, I'll create trouble. What little I know, I only know about gastroenterology. I know only about my field. I don't know about the heart. I don't know about lungs. I don't know about the brain. So that is true, what little I know. But if on my subject, I should be good. I should be clear in my subject. But tomorrow, today, somebody came and started telling me I'm getting dizzy and I'm getting faint. I said, look, that's not my field. I can't help you with that. Go see your, a neurologist, or go see your family doctor. If I start taking care of their dizziness and their back pain, and then I'll get into trouble. So that's why I have to say what little I know. I told that person, I only know gastroenterology. If you have a stomach problem, I can help you. Tell me about your stomach problems. Don't tell me about your heart or your blood pressure. I don't know anything about it. So that's what little I know. Out of the whole body, I know very little, and that is only the stomach, only the digestive system. So I tell them, that's all I know. I can take care of that, but I can't take care of your leg pain or your headache or your, you know, blood pressure. Don't talk to me about that. There are so many medicines, I don't even know the names of some of the new medicines that come out. So that's true. What little I know of the human body, I know very little. I only know a small part of the human body. But then, within that interest, gastroenterology, I have to be good. I have to be an expert. And these Swamijis are, if you ask them any question about Vedanta, they answer it 100%. So you don't look at that, what little I know. Look at how they deal with questions and how the level of teaching, the high level of teaching he was doing. He may say what little I know, but his words don't reflect that. His words reflect a very profound intellect. So don't focus on that one sentence, but see the whole four evenings what he spoke. The level of teaching. So same thing, when you go to a physician, he will say, that's all I know. What little I know, I only know about stomach, or I only know about heart. I don't know anything else. I mean, I'm aware of other things, but I'm not a specialist. So for that, you go to a general practitioner, who knows a little bit of everything. But then he's not a specialist in any one field.
Sometimes people, they don't want to be perceived as arrogant.
Right.
So they use what is called the false modesty.
Uh-huh.
They try to show themselves to the public, they're not arrogant. So what do they say? They say at the beginning, well, maybe I am not the most prepared person for this subject, they say. And that person is very well prepared, has been studying forever, you know all the answers, but it's a way to introduce himself to the public, you know.
True.
But I am not very well prepared. Somebody can tell them, well, you're not well prepared by Bible. Find somebody who is well prepared, because I came to see somebody who is well prepared. But sometimes it's a waste of the speech, you know, just to call the attention.
Yeah, you have to go to the whole entire talk, not only that one sentence. A little late, but we can meditate. The right two switches. Let us detach from our body. Our breath, our thoughts. When I sit for meditation, I'm not a father or a mother or a child or a brother or a sister. I'm neither man nor woman, neither young nor old. I am a seeker of truth. And the truth lies within. I have to go deep within and discover that. I have to discover that I am of the nature of spirit. I am divine, and this body is my instrument, my car, my vehicle. This mind is my equipment. Relax the body from head to toe. Eyes closed. Observe the breath and distance yourself from the breath. Distance yourself from the body. Watch your body from outside. Thoughts arise. distance yourself from the thoughts. I am that eternal spirit. This body, mind, and intellect are my equipment. I am eternal. I was never born. I will never perish. Let us stay with that idea for a few minutes.
Oh.